Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to the 227th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 226 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. That's www.johnmack13.com, and John Mack is JohnMack, so www.johnmack13.com. April brings us in International Poetry Month, and there's a lot going on in this in the area, both in the northern throughout the country, in my local northern Westchester and the adjacent Connecticut area, and on this radio program. I've produced a calendar of the events, and then we'll send one to all to send me a request at johnmack13@gmail.com. And for the last time, John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, so it's johnmack13@gmail.com. But I know that as part of National Poetry Month, I'll be the featured poet on April 9th at the second Monday Poetry at the Stamford, Connecticut Barnes & Noble. And my guest tonight is also a featured poet during the month, in addition to his regular duties as the host of an ongoing weekly poets gathering. More on these activities later. My guest next week, on Easter Sunday, which is also April Fool's Day, will be poet and North Carolina resident L.B. Sedalek, who was the co-featured poet of the week with me a while back on the Poetry Superhighway. Although that show is the first in April, and obviously the actual start of National Poetry Month, we will kick off our celebration tonight a week early with my guest, poet, editor, and publisher Ralph Nazareth, the coordinator of the long-running Tuesday, the Curly's Weekly Poetry Together in Stanford. Ralph is the longtime editor and publisher of poetry, and as well as an advocate and the capable poet in his own right. I first met Ralph at the weekly session at Curly's when a mutual friend, Derry Johnson, was the featured poet. Since then, Ralph and I have corresponded by email, and then he was helpful in putting together the aforementioned calendar. Coincidentally, I also found that the listener to the show, Therese Crane Birch, is an old friend of Ralph's. The listeners wishing to join Ralph and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. So let's get going. Welcome to the show, Ralph.
Thank you very much, John.
Would you start us off with a poem?
Well, I could. Let's see. This poem is from my book called Ferrying Secrets, and the title is Pure Indian. Pure is as pure does. As for the rest, there is blending in ports, at the forks of rivers, confusion in the synapses, enzymes mix as saliva is exchanged between races, sperm and egg conjoin colorblind in the amniotic dream. Cure is as death does, as it lies in state beyond division. Even sworn enemies show up to lay down a wreath, though some of the blooms may drip the blood of your clan. It's with some difficulty I say these words. I am an Indian and wish to be seen as one, composed and taken apart at the meeting and parting of worlds.
That gets me directly into my first question. You are the first non-U.S. born guest I've had on the show. Please tell us something about your childhood in your country of origin.
Well, I was born in that fateful year, 1945, which saw the detonation of atom bombs on civilian populations, and at the same time, the end of the war. And I was born into a Catholic community in what we used to call till recently Hindu India. And a large family, very Orthodox Catholics, in fact, more Roman than Roman Catholics, in a sense that they were very strict adherents to the faith. All three of my sisters became nuns, two of them Poor Clare Franciscans in a cloistered order, and the other one a Carmelite. My father was a coffee planter, and my oldest brother eventually inherited that estate. I have a brother who's a psychiatrist, who's been in this country for over 50 years. And my third brother is a lawyer, scholar, back in India. I have a lot of family in India still.
You mentioned, and you know to me, that your hometown is sometimes called the Rome of the East. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, it's because for any average Indian town, it has a disproportionately high number of Catholics. I mean, every Indian town has a majority of Hindus, including my town. But this one has a great number of Catholics with many, many churches and convents and religious institutions of the Catholic faith.
I was, of course, familiar with the caste system in India, but your description of it in the same note is particularly depressing. Would you give us a brief description of the system as it was then and tell us if there's been any changes since?
Well, the caste system is an ancient institution. Probably there's a lot of speculation about it. Probably started as a basic division of labor. Gradually, it got sort of set into an ironclad system of separation of human from human. And so we have broadly the upper classes, mostly Brahmins, and originally they used to also be called Kshatriyas, the kingly, the upper class, and then Vaishyas, who are the traders, the merchants, and then the Shudras, who are the lowest of the four classes, laborers and so on. And there is a whole panoply of outcasts, casteless people, the oppressed ones, who call themselves Dalits these days. In fact, Mahatma Gandhi, at the height of the freedom struggle, chose to call them Harijans. Harijans means people of God. But B.R. Ambedkar, who is a Dalit himself and a Western-trained lawyer and economist, who was very much a part of the framing of the Indian Constitution, and was very much at odds with Mahatma Gandhi, did not like this designation, people of God, because these so-called people of God continued to be at the lowest levels and outcasts and completely oppressed. And so he wanted to call a spade a spade. So he called them Dalits, who are the oppressed people. So the caste system is deep. It's pervasive. It feels permanent, even though it is legislated against. There is supposedly, you cannot discriminate along caste lines, just as you cannot discriminate against racial lines in this. But racism is alive and well here. So is caste in India. And I, being a product of these two nations, two democracies, which I sometimes call hypocrisies, I'm a more fierce critic of my own India, because it is such an ancient land with a tremendous intellectual, spiritual tradition, and it has no excuse for continuing institutions and systems that are so oppressive. This country, at least, is a tyke in comparison, and racism is a terrible reality here. But caste is equally, if not equally bad, if not worse. So that much for caste.
You also painted a strong picture of you and your sister's reaction to the poverty of local beggars, and the fact that your sister later became the cloistered nun. It sounds like there was a direct connection and a strong reaction to the plight of the poor at a life decision. Or am I reading too much into your note?
No, not at all. I think that my sisters, all three of them joining the religious orders, probably points to the fact that they were turning away from my father's personality of power and empire building. He was a very, very enterprising coffee planter. He was a wonderful man, very generous also, but I think that my sisters turned away from it as a way of turning away from the material world. It was also the 1950s, if you recall. It was a time of Pope Pius XII, and there was a widespread call for vocations all over the world among Catholics. And so there was this rather interesting phenomenon of a lot of young men and women hearing the voice of God and responding to it. I myself, even though I did not become a priest, I felt also that I had to eventually take a stand against a purely materialistic, power-driven life.
That's interesting, because in the 1950s, we still saw the religious life as a higher calling than other vocations. And it was in the 60s and Vatican II that it became thought of as another way to serve God and people, but it was also pointed out that you could just as well do that in the married life or the teaching profession or others. And many of the convents in the United States opened, and many women went into things like the Peace Corps and everything rather than continue. And a lot of the religious orders lost a lot of the participants. Did the same thing happen in India? In the Catholic India?
I would say yes. There is what may be broadly called an aggiornamento in India also. But still, remember I said that Mangalore calls itself the Rome of the East. They still seem to be somewhat orthodox in their approach, and the call to the priesthood or the nunnery is considered to be the highest calling still. But things have shifted. India as a whole is becoming more secular, and the Indian Catholics also, along with them. Many of them are socially active and progressive, and the line between the sacred and the secular, I wouldn't say it is getting blurred, but more and more people are beginning to see that the religious, sacred, holy, and the secular are not two separate paths, but in fact, the call is to see the sacred within the secular, within the temporal. And so that is, in fact, it's a major shift in thinking, certainly post-Vatican II. And it's a wonderful new development.
Before we get into your specific education and career, how about the break for another poem?
Sure. Maybe do a short poem called Glass. I've seen glass blowers stretch little into much. Such is my hope for words, blowing syllables up to hold a world close to breaking.
That is a short poem. I like it. Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
My earliest aspirations, I think the earliest one at the communion rail, was to be taken directly to directly to heaven. But then, of course, there was great pressure on me as part of a very religious family to become a priest. Both the Franciscans and the Jesuits were after me. I went to Jesuit schools and colleges from my kindergarten to my master's in India. I somehow felt that I did not have it in me to become a priest. And interestingly, an American priest who had come looking for vocations in India put into my hands the famous poem by Francis Thompson called The Hound of Heaven. Probably
Hound
you
of
know
Heaven.
It. Yes, it is a terrifying poem where God is the hound coming after the individual soul. I fled him down the nights and down the days and so on. So he actually did the wrong thing if he were looking for me to be a priest, because I fled, went in the other direction. I got a degree in journalism, a master's in English. My hope was to become a journalist. My father, however, had big plans for me. He wanted me to take the Indian administrative exams to become something like the equivalent of a governor of a state. But as I told you earlier, that was not my calling. In fact, after my master's, I joined a Spanish priest named Father Barranco in his work in the villages in Maharashtra state. I worked with him for a while. He told me that I had a wonderful heart, but I was totally useless. because I did not have the kind of skills to help the farmers with what they needed there. So he said, go, you are an intellectual, you're a man of ideas, why don't you go abroad and get a degree? And so I ended up coming to the United States, getting my PhD in English. But when I was doing it, I did not really have any idea of what I wanted to do. Becoming a professor was not really what I was thinking about, but I was just studying in order to study. So my earliest aspirations, I would say, are very much clouded in a lack of clear direction. But gradually things settled down, and I became a professor.
Staying for a moment with Catholic India and the Jesuits, wasn't Francis Xavier the big presence in India early
yes,
in the?
Yes, very big presence. In fact, he was the very first. If you discount the Apostle Saint Thomas. Who was said to have come in the first century to India. And there's a very strong tradition of the Mar Thomites, the St. Thomas Christians in South India, in Kerala. But after the Portuguese came to India in late 15th century, they were followed soon after that by Francis Xavier And he converted a lot of Indians on the West Coast, in the Goa region especially, before he went to the Far East. Yes, Francis Xavier left a very strong mark on my life, for sure. Because he was responsible for the conversions in the area.
You mentioned coming to the United States. Did you find much of the cultural change in your early years here was difficult?
Well, you see, John, I grew up as a Catholic in India, so that was most of my formative years were before Vatican II, which meant that I was somewhat conversant with Latin and Catholic liturgy. So when I came to the West and became part of the Newman community, Catholic Mass here, it was all this universal language and ritual that I was part of. So a very important part of me was not involved in a radical shift at all. Of course, the Vatican II changes were coming into play, and since I was an Anglophone Indian, after all, India claims English as its own language, in addition to its 15, 16, 17 other major languages and 3,000 dialects. For me, it was not difficult because this English is the lingua franca here. So at the deep level of religious consciousness and imagination, at the level of the language, it was very easy for me to float into this culture. There were other things, of course, that were very, very different. I came here in 1968, exactly 50 years ago, when this country was literally falling apart in more than one sense. Vietnam, Cambodia, the death of Martin Luther King Jr., Robert Kennedy. It was a momentous year, and so it was like a blast that hit me.
Understandable. Tell us about the SUNY Steinberg PhD program. What was your dissertation topic?
Well, my dissertation was in tragic theory, and as most dissertations have a kind of a very obscure academic title, mine was The Ironic and Dialectical Foundations of Tragedy. And it fell between stools because it was neither straightforward philosophy nor literary criticism. So it was difficult to find an outside reader for it. Eventually, my dissertation committee inducted Owen Barfield, who was one of the Inklings in England and a friend of C.S. Lewis, to be the outside reader. So it was a very interesting experience. Yes, tragic theory was my field.
When did you actually begin writing poetry?
Well, I wrote when I was a kid, in my teen years in India. Published some things in the college journals and then again in the publications of the English master's program in Bombay University. There was a real ferment in Bombay in the 60s. A lot of Anglophone poets, foreign poets coming through. We were exposed to a lot of British and American poets, in fact, at that time. And so I did start writing then. But in 1968, when I joined the PhD program at Stony Brook, I stopped writing poetry because I was very much into literary theory and drama and so on. But I had the privilege of hearing some of the best known poets of the day, from, you know, Allen Ginsberg and Robert Lowell, to Gary Snyder, to Denise Levertov and others.
Speaking of, poetry, go ahead.
I did not resume writing poetry till about 1980, when I came to Stanford finally, after being at the University of Texas at Austin and then a small stint in Pennsylvania. In 1980, when I came to Stanford, I joined a poetry group called the poetry workshop at the Clay Place in Norwalk, run by one Dale Shaw. So that was really the new beginning for me.
So speaking of poetry, how about another poem?
Sure. Now, I'll read a poem that makes a bow to my American experience. It sort of counterbalances a lot of my hard-hitting and politically driven poetry. It's called Sunday Morning with Walt. It has an epigraph from Walt Whitman. I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume. For every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. The brick oven roars, the steaming bagels, lifted out on smoking paddles, sizzle in the arcing air, and thud into labeled bins, warm in diversity. Sesame, poppy, oatmeal, plain, salt, pumpernickel, black, brown, yellow, pale, glowing orbs, burnished gold, some with everything. In line this Sunday morning, I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume. For every bagel that belongs to me as well belongs to you.
That's both very strong and very academic. What did you do after obtaining the PhD?
Well, I taught for a while, since that was a very down period for jobs for English PhDs. I taught for a while at Stony Brook, then at UT Austin as an adjunct, then became a house husband. My wife worked. We moved to Pennsylvania. And I continued my stint as Mr. Mom in Stanford. And when my children were approximately, you know, around the age of 7 and 10, three of them, I decided to go back to work. And I found that I was disqualified from everything except teaching. So I interviewed for the only two jobs that were available. Then I got both of them, one at SUNY Farmingdale and the other one at NASA Community College. And I took the one at NASA because it was 20 miles closer to home from Stanford. So that's what I did. And then I stayed at NASA for almost three decades.
Do you have a real history of peace and justice activism? Although one can never really generalize, I've worked with many of Indian origin in my career in technology, and their focus seem consumed by that field, as well as their family. You've already mentioned your background in religion. Would you call that the grounding that brought you to activism?
Yes, John. I was heavily influenced by Dan and Philip Berrigan and Thomas Merton. And, of course, I loved the balance between the out-and-out activists and the monk contemplative who was, in fact, the dynamo for the activists, very much shaped by them and Dorothy Day. And my own Indian background with my own, it's hard to speak about it, but yes, I was very sensitive to the extraordinary poverty in India, and always wanting to do something about it. So I think that carried over. When I came to here, this country, and became very much a part of the anti-war movement, going to every demonstration in Washington and so on, all of it had to do with, you know, war, anti-war, justice, joined groups like the anti-nuclear movement, Stanford Citizen Action Group. I was able to do some of this because my wife then, my deceased wife, we were married for 40 years. She died in 2008. she was very accommodating. She worked all day, and when she came home, she freed me to go and do all my committee work for all these groups. So I did a lot of mobilizing and organizing during those years, and I've not stopped doing it. At the college, at NASA Community College, the big moment, of course, was 9/11, and 2003 was our disastrous shock and awe, the destruction of Baghdad. Soon after that, I started a group at NASA called Peace Work, and I kept it going for until I retired in 2015. A wonderful, you know, group of activist students working both locally and nationally. Basically, it was a kind of an education in understanding what it means to be residents or citizens of the most powerful nation in the world, with all our destructive capability and all the hope and the promise that this country holds for itself and for the rest of the planet. So that's, in brief, my story about my activism.
You mentioned Dan Berrigan. I had some contact with Dan, both in interviewing him, and I did a retreat with him, and I also heard him at the both the Catholic Worker and at the Thomas Merton, a life center that was founded at Columbia. And two things that strike out. One about writing. When I interviewed him, it was when writers were beginning to use computers, and Dan had a K-Pro, and if you remember, of course, he wrote both poetry and prose, and he only wrote prose on a computer. He wrote poetry in longhand, and he felt that there was a specific difference in the medium that lent itself to either being able to constantly edit and to make changes as you could on a computer, or stream of consciousness in just writing and crossing out and writing and crossing out until you are ready to publish. Does that make sense to you?
It does makes a lot of sense. It did, in fact, for the longest time. I would always be with my pad and pen, writing longhand, doing, you know, it's wonderful to see a page with lots crossed out and revisions and so on. It's all there. I was a holdout for a very long time against the computer, but I don't know what to say now. There is a certain degree of nostalgia there. I've begun to compose more directly on the computer. And I have a fairly large screen, so it's possible to have multiple drafts on the screen spread out at the same time. And the process seems to be very similar to actually working with paper and pencil or pen. I would say there is some sort of a mystique. I want to say it is not mystification, but a mystique to the actual acts of the fingers hitting the page, something palpable and tactile that we don't seem to have when we compose on the computer. Would this be result in a qualitative difference in composition? Would it in fact lead to the accessing of certain regions of the mind and the imagination, and in a radically different way? One can theorize endlessly about this, but I have to say that I have crossed over the divide now. I'm very much composing on the computer, and it's my friend. It used to be a hostile agent, but it's now my friend.
The other thing with Dan, and I only found this out when I did a retreat with him up here at the place, and it was really a Christian retreat rather than a Catholic, with so many of the people that were there. And it was a small group. Some drove all the way from Cincinnati, and been listening to Dan and speak to a large audience, and then reading his thing, and then obviously all of the news stories about him being chased around by various government agencies. You had the impression of a firebrand and exhorting people to do things. In person, he was a witness. Mm-hmm. He was very quiet, and you had the feeling of, look at this guy that does all this stuff, and what the hell are you doing? You know, he was like challenging you just by his physical presence, and it was very different than his public persona. I found that extremely interesting.
Isn't that what they say about Thomas Merton as well? That is, here's a contemplative, not an overt activist, but he was also given to a very different way with people. He was loud and full of laughter, loved his beer and hot dog. I mean, the kind of, you know, complexity that you're pointing out in Dan Berrigan exists in a slightly different way in Thomas Merton, and I love that mixture. You know, it is not a flirtation with some sort of a severe orthodoxy or purity.
And Dan's book about seven people who influenced him, he regards Merton as a spiritual father or his brother. In a biography of Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton and let's see, who else was it? Walker Percy and you had the impression that that Merton thought that Dan was a little too far out there, that he was too much of a physical activist for his own calling. So I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I think Merton was shocked by that activist suicide. The Dan and Philip and all were sort of behind it, in the sense that it was their activism that led to that young man's suicide, and Merton tried to dissociate himself from it. But then I think he came around and said that he did not have the right to judge.
You also founded your own publishing brand in 1986. Tell us about the decision to do that. What was involved in that?
Well, this group that I was part of, the Clay Plays, had some wonderful poets in it, especially the famous Ruth Krauss. Hole is to Dig, The Carrot Seed, and all books that generations of children have enjoyed. Wonderful poet. My deceased wife and I, Linda and I, decided to start a publishing firm called Yuganta Press, and a little anthology of the work of these poets called On This Crust of Earth was the first publication. Since then, we have published many books. We were looking for books that made a movement between worlds, because I'm an Indian. My deceased wife, Linda, was an American. And so we were looking for manuscripts that actually were in some ways broadly intercultural. And I have pretty much stayed true to that original commitment. We published quite a few poets and launched some careers. Several of our poets have become fairly well known, participated in the Dodge Festival. Two of our poets became poet laureates, one of Suffolk County and the other one of Nassau County. So we have, it's a small press, not a big run, but selective and serious.
You mentioned that there after that you began teaching at Nassau Community College, and you have for 27 years. You've already talked about founding Peace Work. Take us through your career there? Were you teaching literature courses, poetry courses?
In the beginning, I was appointed as director of the writing center there. And then I switched over to teaching a whole range of courses from, obviously, at a community college, do a lot of writing, so basic writing, to advanced courses like the Bible as literature, film and literature, literature of the Holocaust. And one of my favorite courses was The Making of the Modern Mind, a fairly advanced course in philosophy and art and politics and history. South Asian literature, because of my background, I was particularly well suited to teach that one. So I did that. I loved teaching at the community college. Initially, it was a bit of a, because most of us dreamt of teaching at some Ivy League institution. But once some of us came to understand the real challenge of transforming consciousness, there seemed to be nothing better than teaching at a college where the students had to be built up, literally from the root up. They came with very little background literacy, cultural literacy. So it was a wonderful opportunity to give them something, and most of the students were very, very grateful and very responsive. 9/11 happened when I was there. I was invited by the president and vice president to come and address the college along with a couple of other professors. That was a very important moment in my tenure there. It is a controversial moment. I need to talk about it at greater length, but we can't do it in this interview here. Then there was some militancy against one of the presidents of the college, and I was involved. I was in the front ranks of leading a movement against his tenure, and we ousted him because he was not good for the college. So I was involved in a lot of that. A kind of a merging of academics and activism, all in the name of really shoring up the foundations of what we felt was an academic institution which should not be allowed to lapse into merely a vocational school. So, in brief, that is then my trajectory there.
In many ways, there is a demand now for colleges, even the Ivies and others, to become vocational, because we keep talking about what good jobs that people get after it. Now, of course, I graduated years ago, but I had no clue. Other than the engineers and the accountants then, most of us went to school thinking that we needed an education, and towards senior year, we'd figure it out, you know, what we were going to do. You don't seem to see that very much anymore. It seems to be, you know, to what are the jobs, what are the highest ranking things, what is the preparation, and I think that's sad, I think. But
I think it's sad, but I think, if I may say this, the sort of stark line that is drawn between the so-called vocational approach and the academic one is not advisable and so strictly ultimately not viable, because I think we need to have workers who are well-informed. So we need to have an educated force, whether it is at the level of manufacturing and production or white-collar workers or intellectual workers. We should have some sort of an integrated approach to these things. I think that the division is basically intensified by self-seeking corporations that are pushing their agenda of having a workforce that can be exploited, easily manipulated, and had for a song. And I think that was part of my politics, and I'm happy to note that many of my colleagues who continue to work not only at NASA and other places are struggling to keep this particular approach alive out there, that we should not sell ourselves short by saying that we need workers. What sort of workers do we need? We need thinking sort of workers and feeling sort of workers. People who will, cannot be manipulated easily. That can happen only if you've taught them how to think, how to be philosophers in the best sense of the term.
You mentioned that 2 years after the 9/11 speech that you founded Peace Work. Also in the same year, you became involved with the group The Curleys that I mentioned earlier. How did that start up?
You mean The Curleys, Diana? Yes. My friend Annie Armal, who was herself an activist, she had joined the Peace Corps and gone to St. Lucia, a poet whom I had published, North Star and the Southern Cross is the book I published. It's work that came out of her experience in St. Lucia in the Caribbean. When she started this group called Poem Alley at the Unitarian Universalist Society in Stamford, the proprietress of Curley's Diner, Eleni Begetis Anastos, a fierce fighter for rights, human rights, joined the Universalists, and when she felt like the group should meet at Curley's Diner, and so they started meeting there approximately around 2000. And when Anne moved to Arizona in 2004, I stepped in, and I've been running it since. And I've been part of a rather marvelous community, very, very engaged. The diner itself is a place of resistance. All the glass towers are coming up all around it. And the Greek sisters have stood firm against, shall we call it, empire. And they're trying to fight for their rights or fight for a decent offer from the powers that be. And they have been generous enough to let us meet on a weekly basis now for almost 20 years. It's been a place of ferment, a safe space for poets to come and feel free. And in that space, we've had people coming out of drug rehabilitation, people who are homeless and coming from the shelters to tell us their stories. It's been really a human place, a place where people have felt a modicum of human dignity and freedom and liberation. I'm really enormously excited about it. It's an aging group now. Yesterday we had a memorial service for one of our poets who passed away last week. We have lost 6 poets in the last 6 or 7 years. And the challenge is to attract young people and hold them. And I've not been particularly successful in doing that. So we are constantly trying to figure out ways to address these issues. How to attract the younger people, not only so that they learn from the elders, but for the elders to understand how language is moving, how words are being used in different ways, and a new sort of politics. We're open to it.
I think that one of the biggest problems with poetry is that many people that turned off on it in both grammar school and in high school, I know I came back to it late after being an English major and when I graduated, but I not only didn't write a poem 35 years, I didn't read a poem for 35 years and until just the freak occurrence got me back into it. You published 2 anthologies from Curley's. I have the first one, and the second one is unfortunately out of print. If I knew who to burglarize for the second anthology, I would.
Yes,
tell us about how you happened to put the anthologies together.
No, that was a no-brainer. I mean, there was a lot of wonderful work coming out, and we just got down to it and selected the poems and put them together, and both those collections. In fact, there are 2 other collections that were not perfect bound. They were stapled books. Against the Fence was a book that came out of a resistance to Curly's being pulled down by the corporations. So these anthologies are a reflection of the kind of engaged work that we have been doing there over the years. I'm no longer king of an anthology because, you know, people are reading, if they're reading at all, they read a lot online, a poem or so, and be done with it. It's no longer feasible to actually publish books and make a go of it. Only the well-known poet, you know, if the poet sells 500 or 1,000 copies, he or she is lucky.
There are some very good poetry groups on Facebook and on the net, the poetry and the poetry superhighway. There's a whole bunch of these, and perhaps they will energize young poets to be looking for groups and be looking to meet other people and to read the masters and do whatever. There are also some excellent online courses at Coursera on poetry from various places throughout the country. So I do feel that there's more of a hope than there was 30 years ago. I would hope so.
I think so. Yes, I agree with you. There is the opportunities are out there. Having led this group and thinking a little bit about my own practice, I think what is key is something that is a community that sustains you, that sort of keeps you writing and gives you the discipline, gives you an audience that is always there to work with you and so on. So, yes, the opportunities are out there, but if it's not to be just sort of a passing trend, once again, those online forces will have to know a little bit about genuine community formation so that an individual poet feels that his or her work is part of not something just transient and ephemeral, but something solid, even though it is in the virtual medium. In connection with this, if I may say, John, a few years after my wife died, I met a wonderful poet from the Dominican Republic named Marianela Medrano, who is now my wife. We've been married now. And my last 6 years with her has opened up to me this enormous world of Latin American poetry. And I've traveled to Colombia, Ecuador, El Salvador, and other places. And I've been introduced to this extraordinary world of Latin American poetic communities. I think we have something to learn from them. I don't know whether it is just a kind of a aspect of Latin American culture, that kind of ebullience, that warm-heartedness, that openness to vision, and that poetry is for everybody. Poetry is bread. It's everybody, for everybody. That idea, in other words, the North American proclivity to have poetry in the academy, you know, completely sort of taken out in the Latin American context, where poetry belongs in the marketplace, in the stadia. My wife is an organizer of poetry gatherings, and she brings a great diversity of poets, young and old. And I'm so impressed. I think we in the Anglophone communities have something to learn from it. I wonder what it is. I mean, I still haven't figured it out. What is the secret of their I would say almost electrifying gatherings?
Yeah, it's interesting. And you mentioned, I was going to mention this later, that in 2008 you lost your spouse of 40 years. That must have been a real shock. Barbara and I I'm married 40 years in May, and obviously that hit home to when I saw that. I'm very happy that you're able to find another life, and I know that Latin America in so many things has a history, not only in poetry but in novels, and in the whole liberation theology movement and everything. So it's for years we in North America tended to discount the Latin in South America, and obviously that was a big mistake. So
yes, do you suppose I'm speculating now. Do you suppose it may have something to do with some very deep issues about one's relationship to the body, for instance, to family, one's relationship to time? Because I think that North America, especially as after the great Whitman, until, let's say, Ginsberg, there was a complexification of poetry, kind of withdrawal into private space, into the academy, disembodied, alienated stuff. Latin American poetry, I mean, most of these poets I meet, they are so much in the body, and the body contiguous with, naturally flowing into a holding of hands, that is, community or family. I think that there's something deep there, a kind of a deep difference between the way Anglophone or the Nordic poetry developed over a period of years and the kind of stuff that you think about when you hear of Neruda addressing, reading his poetry to a whole stadium, a football stadium of people, you know. So different.
It's possibly, and you start me thinking, but there's also, of course, and you could get this in my old neighborhood, an Irish Catholic neighborhood, there's the Puritanism that was built in and the Jansenistic tradition, and Germany was considered rather cold like that too, whether or not it deserved to be, whereas most of the non-Indian culture, and I'm talking about Native rather than,
yes,
than Indian, but that had the Spanish influence that was always considered a hotter, and it was not bogged down in the certainly the Puritanism of England and Ireland. So maybe it's just the roots, and from the roots to evolve differently. So
yes, I think so. I think so. That's the reason I mentioned the body as maybe the fulcrum there. May I read a poem that sort of indicates some of this, my movement into Latin American stuff and the body? May I read a poem?
Sure. Go ahead.
It's called Victor Jara's Hands. It has a little epigraph. 2 days after the coup, Pinochet's junta seized him and took him to the detention center at the Santiago Sports Stadium. He was singled out by the tormentors, who tortured him, and then broke his hands. They were delicate, his wife said, fingers slender and lithe, like those of an Indian dancer. They soothed the cuts and bruises their daughters suffered at play. She did not say how those hands held her face, or what everyone knew, how they released songbirds from the cage of his guitar, or how they held throngs of campesinos by the magic of their plucking, or slapped out songs about hands that brought in the harvest, fed the kilns, threw pots, delivered babies, blackened in the mines, hauled in the nets, boned the fish, raised a glass to say salud. She did not say, could not say, how they come to me at night here in the north, twin messengers would take me by the shoulders and whisper, it's all right, not to stop weeping.
Thank you very much for that one. After you left Nassau Community College, you began volunteering at the maximum security prisons. In another coincidence, I have done some consulting for the president of Marist College, one of the ones that you volunteered, Greenhaven. And now you are at Sing Sing. How did you get into this? And tell us about what you do in this role.
Well, a friend of mine named Suzanne Einbeiter, whose book called Devi, it's a Sanskrit for goddess, I published, Uganda Press published. She is a comparative religionist from Columbia University, and she started teaching for a program called Rising Hope at Greenhaven. And they were looking for someone to teach English composition to the men. And she asked me if I wanted to do it, and I said, I do enough of that sort of teaching at the college, but if they would let me teach creative writing, I would do it. I would agree to do it. And so they said yes, and I started driving to Greenhaven. And within the first 3 years, I compiled about 250 pages of extraordinary writing by these men. The title of the book was going to be I Do Not Remember the Last Time I Saw the Stars. But the state of New York stopped me from publishing it. That's another story. And then Rising Hope was shut down at Greenhaven and moved to Sing Sing. So this is my 13th year of teaching maximum security. And I have to say that this has been among the most important experiences in my life. In fact, I'll just give you one sentence by one of the men fairly early on. He was in Greenhaven. They are all serving very long sentences. They are practically entombed. This man wrote, I haunt myself daily, waiting to be revealed. I find that to be a stunning, stunning declaration and a plea. And, you know, all of our journeys of, you know, self-discovery, self-realization and all of that raised to such a pitch in the case of a man who is working behind the walls and entombed in a way. I haunt myself daily, waiting to be revealed. Yes.
In the 1990s, Marist had a bachelor's program there, and one of the inmates had an idea for a way to be able to make significant improvements in the way people did computer programming, to be able to get things out, to do them more rapidly with less errors. And he got the attention of the president, who asked me to look into it and to make a recommendation into whether I thought there's a commercial product there. And I'll never forget the first day that I drove there. I was in this Volkswagen, then I parked, you know, it looked like a space to me, and I heard this voice, in the Volkswagen, you have to move that car. It was like the voice of God. It was someone from the tower, you know, through a thing. I was in the space that I couldn't have been in. And then I moved it, and then I was there for a while. And unfortunately, the program was shut down. The funding was. Dutchess Community College had a two-year program that continued. But the idea, it was so cynical, because there were people on the floor of Congress, and some in New York State, and I'll never forget this person on the floor of Congress saying, do you know that we are providing educational funds for rapists and for murderers and hard-working farmers in my district who do not have the income that would let them fall into this category? They cannot get college help for their children. Well, as soon as, and it, they eventually killed the programs, but as soon as they did that, this money didn't go to this hardworking farmer. You know, it was this complete sham. It wasn't that you know, that there was some inequity there and we're going to straighten it out. You know, the money just went away. You know, so it was, I wasn't happy with it.
Well, I have to use a stronger word than sham. I think that the prison industrial complex is a scandal. You know, Pussy Riot, the famous rock group in Russia, whenever they travel, wherever they go, they ask their hosts to first take them to their prison, the local prison, because they say that society is judged by the way they treat their own brothers and sisters who have fallen. And there is no context. You don't know why the men and the women are in prison. We have no sense of our own complicity, our silence, our neglect, systemic neglect, our societal silence that has partly caused this catastrophe in the lives of people. And what are we going to do, to use Auden's words, to undo the folded lie? I call it a scandal because it's just built on lies. Most of my men have committed serious crimes, no doubt.
I'd say even more than that, because of the privatization of prisons, where there's money to be made, and very strong in many states of the security and prison guards, that there is a complete opposition to things like the dealing with drugs as an illness rather than a crime, and getting the non of violent people out of prisons and into programs and things like this. And it's such strong opposition because there's so much money there. And I think that's just a complete scandal, to use your word. You know,
Yes, it's a scandal. Yes.
In 2011, you founded Graceworks. What is Graceworks?
Well, Graceworks is a charitable foundation, non-profit, non-denominational, and we support projects in India and Africa. And we've done it in active fundraising for 2 years. We have helped build an underground water cistern. We have helped build a school in a remote area in Tanzania. And our hope is to bring the work to our own neighborhood, so to say, to Haiti, to the Dominican Republic. The need is great here. So I'm just learning the ropes. Fundraising is the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. But I'm going to keep at it because there are a lot of people of goodwill who, despite the fact that they are pressed on all sides, they are themselves needy, do not have much to give. Nevertheless, their large-heartedness makes them open their, you know, wallets and give something. And the Graceworks is built on the notion that when we say charity begins at home, we try to point out that we've got to see that the world is our home. Otherwise, we have, you know, we are limited to this very narrow way of, you know, not feathering our own nest, but securing our own space. But we have to think in planetary and global terms. And if we try to do something about poverty elsewhere, then we have a better chance of being a world community and fewer people knocking down our doors to wanting to enter from the nations that we ourselves have laid waste over a period of 100 years. So Graceworks is a charitable foundation, but fully understands that at the core level, the work that it does is necessarily political and, you know, broadly, what shall I say, human rights. It's human rights work. It is reaching out to the ones who are down and out and who need help.
What is next for you, Ralph?
Well, I think that if I can continue Grace Works, build it up. The dream is not to become very big, but to have enough to be able to supply funds in a sustained manner, and help improve the lives of people here. That would be a dream fulfilled. And from a personal point of view, there's a lot of writing that still needs to be done. And my question, my perpetual sort of a question to myself is, what is the point of it? What is the relevance of it? How should I move forward as a writer? What is self-expression in relation to the transformation of the world that I live in? Every poet asks these questions, and the answers are not there to hand. I mean, they're not easy. But I think that's one of the things that I want to continue to do. I'm in my seventh decade. I've been extremely fortunate in my life. I've received tremendous gifts, and I need to continue to give them back to people, all sorts of people, poets and people out there who are at the receiving end of a lot of pain, who are people in pain and who are poor, who are sick, who are hungry. And that's my hope.
As we get older, we realize that the answers to these questions aren't obvious, certainly not as obvious as they were when we were in our 20s. We've covered a lot of bases in exploring your interesting and very productive life. What else would you like our audience to know about Ralph Nazareth?
Ralph Nazareth has a sense of humor. I love to laugh. It often doesn't come out because of my drooping beard. People think that I'm a deadly serious guy, which I am, but I'll read you a little ditty, a little poem that gives, it's sort of a sampling of my mischief. It has a long title and the poem is very short. The title is Chicken Little on the Verge of Applying to the 99th International Nudist Conference Asks for a Crucial Clarification. Is the heart a private part?
That is cute.
What's more for me, that is to continue to explore the ways of the heart and bring them in line with my intellectual cast of mind. And I would say that's a spiritual project, wouldn't you?
I would. And thank you very much for tonight, Ralph. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, John, for giving me the opportunity.
I hope that all the guests and all the audience will be back next week for my interview as we head into National Poetry Month. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose after the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, for your also previous shows and the schedule of upcoming shows. And once again, I hope you'll be with us next Sunday. And until then, as they say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Alexa, play Amazing Grace by Joan Baez, please.
Here's a sample of the president saying Amazing Grace by Joan Baez.
And for an hour, the stranger stayed. He sat with them and he seemed to pray.
Thanks again, Ralph, and good night, everybody.